wordt Limbaugh een geuzennaam. Artikel gepubliceerd in 2010 en, kijkend naar de Catalanen, steeds actueler. Wat doe je de avond dat je vakantie start? Terwijl ik wat zaken aan het doornemen ben, dwalen mijn gedachten terug naar een artikel in De Pers van 3 augustus 2010. Titel, Limbo's onder elkaar, Limburgers grijpen de macht in kamer. Weer zo'n typisch kop, dacht ik toen mijn ogen erop vielen, Hollandse perceptie ten voeten uit. Ze hadden ook kunnen zeggen in diezelfde kop dat er een meer gespreide machtsbalans aan het opkomen is. Enerzijds voelt de gemiddelde Hollander absoluut niet aan wat er in Nederland in de periferie echt aan het gebeuren is. Maar tegelijk raakt dit artikel wel een punt. Ik zei 2 jaar terug, lees, 2008, nog tegen een Limburgse kennis dat het me zo opviel de laatste 10 jaar dat er een ware cultuurexplosie heeft plaatsgevonden in die provincie, en nog steeds doorgaat. Eigen Limbo Top 100, trots op eigen Limburgse taal, talrijke Limburgse culturele manifestaties, Limburgse artiesten etc. Zeker als je, zoals ik, er zelden meer bent. Dan valt dat op, een soort hernieuwd Limburgs zelfbewustzijn mede gestimuleerd door de regionale eigen televisiezenders. Ik grapte nog, hier zie je het einde van de Amsterdams, Haagse, Hollandse, VOC-psychologische overmacht waarbij je als regio's, in jouw belevenis, niet echt meetelde. Aan alles komt vroeg of laat een eind. Wellicht is mijn perceptie ook beïnvloed door een boek van Kenichi Omai, The Rise of the Region States, ik bedoel, The End of the Nation States, dat ik zo'n 15 jaar geleden las en mij toen het gevoel gaf dat hij een serieus punt had. Zie ook, https://www.foreignaffairs.com/articles/1993-03-01/rise-region-staten. Wat voor mij als Limburger van huis uit dus een duidelijke trend is, is dat dit toenemend regionaal zelfbewustzijn, en niet alleen in Limburg, ook de centrale Haagse macht sluipenderwijs aantast. Ga maar na. In Limburg woon je op een plek waar je ook de invloed voelt van België en Duitsland. Dat zijn eigenlijk je directe buren. Die, van boven de Moerdijk, maken, van binnen naar buiten, wetten en regels, Holland-centrisch, die in een regio als Limburg soms anders uitwerken. Een lichte irritatie tegenover Hollands denken is mede daarvan het gevolg. Nog los van de geografische afstand die deze irritatie eveneens beïnvloedt, ook al is Nederland een klein land. Als je aan de grens woont, ben je, in jouw belevenis, het meest vatbaar voor inbraken en rommel van niet-Nederlanders. Zeker nu die grens geen echte grens meer is, zijn die inbrekers zo weer weg. En dan praten we nog niet eens over drugstoerisme en coffeeshops en het type mensen dat je daarmee aantrekt, zoals ze die bijvoorbeeld in Maastricht, maar ook Bergen-op-Zoom en Roosendaal met onder andere de sluiting van die coffeeshops de stad uitwerken met, natuurlijk, verplaatsing naar andere grensgebieden waar zich dit wegwerken uiteraard vroeg of laat weer gaat herhalen. Dan is het niet vreemd dat een man als Geert Wilders een grote invloed in Limburg krijgt. Bovendien is hij van de Limburgse Region-Staten. Dus gecombineerd met een hernieuwd zelfbewustzijn gaan we het heft maar eens in eigen handen nemen, Limburgse personal accountability. Baks, Limburg neemt zijn verantwoordelijkheid voor de planeet Aarde. Terzijde, dat heft in eigen handen nemen, zie je ook terug op andere terreinen. Bijvoorbeeld op het gebied van duurzaamheid. Limburg volgt niet maar kiest voor een leidende positie. De gemeente Venlo is naar eigen zeggen de eerste die als gehele regio cradle to cradle heeft omarmd. Met dito C2C masteropleiding in die stad. Zie onder andere http://tinyurl.com/2v4n5 af. De provincie heeft een tiental plaatsen aangewezen om C2C nieuwbouw te ontwikkelen. En dit is pas het begin. Het is een combinatie van culturele bloei en de bijbehorende creativiteit met ecologische regionale zelfvoorzienendheid, zelfstandigheid. Dat is een mondiale thema van belang zijn voor de aarde als plaats waar we leven. Mogelijk is deze region-staten, initiatiefrijkheid, ook maar een tijdelijke ontwikkeling kijkend naar de wijze waarop de generatie van na 85 opgroeit. Deze is wellicht meer footloose geworden. Toch twijfelt mijn gevoel er sterk over dat dit footloose gebeuren de eerder genoemde culturele ontwikkeling negatief gaat beïnvloeden. Eerder positief, je weet hoe je een regio een plaats en invloed te geven in het grotere geheel. Bovenstaande nog eens lezend lijkt me dit een interessant contrastscenario, dat Haagse departementen zouden kunnen uitwerken. De gedachte dat de wereld een lappendeken wordt van regionale staatjes. Zonder echte centrale machten. Misschien blijken die kleine landjes uitermate effectief met elkaar handel te kunnen drijven. Misschien krijgen ze op de een of andere wijze allemaal respect voor de eisen die de aarde aan haar bewoners stelt om op deze planeet te kunnen leven. Hoe ziet er dat uit? Wat zou dit kunnen veroorzaken? Ongetwijfeld zullen EU-fans, of mensen die in internationale gremia werken, dit als een onmogelijk scenario zien. Maar daarom is het ook een contrastscenario. Zo'n scenario geeft vanuit een bepaald kader antwoord op de vraag, wat lijkt onmogelijk, maar als het gebeurt, zet het ons huidige beleidsdenken, en onze manier van beleidsontwikkeling, volledig op zijn kop. Vergroot het Rise of the Region States gebeuren eens uit. Een nuttige exercitie om uit het normale denkpatroon te komen. Bedenk daarbij dat veranderingen vrijwel altijd aan de zijlijn beginnen. Nooit in het centrum van de macht. Max Herold Augustus, 2010. Meer weten, via bol.com. The End of the Nation State Kenichi Omai. Globalisering en de nieuwe orde in de wereldeconomie Kenichi Omai. The Next Global Stage Kenichi Omai. The Borderless World Kenichi Omai via managementboek.nl. Samenvatting van Globalisering, we leven in een wereld van netwerken en onderlinge afhankelijkheid, verenigd in een mondiale economie. De globalisering beïnvloedt leven en werken ingrijpend, op allerlei niveaus. Sommige consequenties zien we al doorwerken in landen als China, Finland, Italië en Ierland. Daar zijn economische regio's in opkomst waar bepaalde activiteiten gecentreerd worden op een manier die wereldwijde concurrentie mogelijk maakt, iets wat aan het betreffende land zelf, als natiestaat, niet voorbehouden is. Kenichi Omai bespreekt in dit boek de rijkwijde van deze regio's, de rol van de traditionele politiek erin, de consequenties voor de handel op lange termijn en wat u er in uw functie als ondernemer of leider van een organisatie van moet weten. Omai is erin geslaagd de grote lijnen duidelijk te schetsen en tegelijk de implicaties ervan op bedrijfsniveau gedetailleerd in te vullen. Een must voor executives, beleidsmakers en denkers over globalisering. Inhoudsopgave. Inleiding de plot het toneel deel 1 het toneel 1. De wereldtournee 2. De première 3. Economische wetenschap aan het eind van haar Latijn deel 2 regieaanwijzingen 4. Spelmakers 5. Platforms voor vooruitgang 6. Erop uit 7. De ketenen breken deel 3 het script 8. Een nieuwe vorm van overheid 9. De termijnmarkt 10. Het volgende bedrijf 11. Postscriptum zie verder. http://www.managementboek.nl/book/9789047001713/globalisering-kenichi-omai-affiliate-1910. The Rise of the Region State. By Kenichi Omai about the author, the nation state has become unnatural, even dysfunctional, unit for organizing human activity and managing economic endeavor in a borderless world. It represents no genuine, shared community of economic interests, it defines no meaningful flows of economic activity. In fact, it overlooks the true linkages and synergies that exist among often disparate populations by combining important measures of human activity at the wrong level of analysis. For example, to think of Italy as a single economic entity ignores the reality of an industrial north and a rural south, each vastly different in its ability to contribute and in its need to receive. Treating Italy as a single economic unit forces one as a private sector manager or a public sector official to operate on the basis of false, implausible and non-existent fair wages. Italy is a country with great disparities in industry and income across regions. On the global economic map, the lines that now matter are those defining what may be called region states. The boundaries of the region state are not imposed by political fiat. They are drawn by the deft but invisible hand of the global market for goods and services. They follow, rather than precede, real flows of human activity, creating nothing new but ratifying existing patterns manifest in countless individual decisions. They represent no threat to the political borders of any nation, and they have no call on any taxpayers' money to finance military forces to defend such borders. Region states are a natural economic zones. They may or may not fall within the geographic limits of a particular nation, whether they do is an accident of history. Sometimes these distinct economic units are formed by parts of states, such as those in northern Italy, Wales, Catalonia, Alsace-Lorraine or Baden-Württemberg. At other times they may be formed by economic patterns that overlap existing national boundaries, such as those between San Diego and Tijuana, Hong Kong and southern China, or the Growth Triangle of Singapore and its neighboring Indonesian islands. In today's borderless world, these are natural economic zones, and what matters is that each possesses, in one or another combination, the key ingredients for successful participation in the global economy. Look, for example, at what is happening in Southeast Asia. The Hong Kong economy has gradually extended its influence throughout the Pearl River Delta. The radiating effect of these linkages has made Hong Kong, where GNP per capita is $12,000, the driving force of economic life in Shenzhen, boosting the per capita GNP of that city's residents to $5,595, as compared to $317 for China as a whole. These links extend to Zhuhai, Amoy and Guangzhou as well. By the year 2000, this cross-border region state will have raised the living standard of more than 11 million people over the $5,000 level. Meanwhile, Guangdong Province, with a population of more than 65 million and its capital at Hong Kong, will emerge as a newly industrialized economy in its own right, even though China's per capita GNP may still hover at about $1,000, unlike in Eastern Europe, where nations try to convert entire socialist economies over to the market. The Asian model is first to convert limited economic zones, the region states, into free enterprise havens. So far the results have been reassuring. These developments and others like them are coming just in time for Asia. As Europe perfects its single market and as the United States, Canada and Mexico begin to explore the benefits of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, the combined economies of Asia and Japan lag behind those of the other parts of the globe's economic triad by about $2 trillion, roughly the aggregate size of some 20 additional region states. In other words, for Asia to keep pace, existing regions must continue to grow at current rates throughout the next decade, giving birth to 20 additional Singapores. Many of these new region states are already beginning to emerge. China has expanded to 14 other areas, many of them in lengthy special economic zones that have worked so well for Shenzhen and Shanghai. One such project at Yunnan will become a cross-border economic zone encompassing parts of Laos and Vietnam. In Vietnam itself, Ho Chi Minh City, Saigon, has launched a similar safe zone to attract foreign capital. Inspired in part by Singapore's Growth Triangle, the governments of Indonesia, Malaysia and Thailand, in 1992 unveiled a larger triangle across the Strait of Malacca to link Medan, Penang and Phuket. These developments are not, of course, limited to the developing economies in Asia. In economic terms, the United States has never been a single nation. It is a collection of region states, Northern and Southern California, the Power Corridor, along the East Coast between Boston and Washington, the Northeast, the Midwest, the Sun Belt, and so on. What makes a region state? The primary linkages of region states tend to be with the global economy and not with their host nations. Region states make such effective points of entry into the global economy because the very characteristics that define them are shaped by the demands of that economy. Region states tend to have between 5 million and 20 million people. The range is broad, but the extremes are clear, not half a million, not 50 or 100 million. A region state must be small enough for its citizens to share certain economic and consumer interests, but of adequate size to justify the infrastructure, communication and transportation links and quality professional services necessary to participate economically on a global scale. It must, for example, have at least one international airport and, more than likely, one good harbor with international class freight handling facilities. A region state must also be large enough to provide an attractive market for the brand development of leading consumer products. In other words, region states are not deafened by their economies of scale in production, which, after all, can be leveraged from a base of any size through exports to the rest of the world, but rather by their having reached efficient economies of scale in their consumption, infrastructure and professional services. For example, as the reach of television networks expands, advertising becomes more efficient. Although trying to introduce a consumer brand throughout all of Japan or Indonesia may still prove prohibitively expensive, establishing it firmly in the Osaka or Jakarta region is far more affordable and far more likely to generate handsome returns. Much the same is true with sales and service networks, customer satisfaction programs, market surveys and management information systems. Efficient scale is at the regional, not national, level. This fact matters because, on balance, modern marketing technique and technologies shape the economies of region states. Where true economies of service exist, religious, ethnic and racial distinctions are not important or, at least, only as important as human nature requires. Singapore is 70% ethnic Chinese, but its 30% minority is not much of a problem because commercial prosperity creates sufficient affluence for all. Nor are the ethnic differences a source of concern for potential investors looking for consumers. Indonesia, an archipelago with 500 or so different tribal groups, 18,000 islands and 170 million people would logically seem to defy effective organization within a single model of political government. Yet Jakarta has traditionally attempted to impose just such a central control by applying fictional affair ages to the entire nation. They do not work. However, economies of service allow two or three Singapore-sized region states to be created within Indonesia, they could be managed. And they would ameliorate, rather than exacerbate, the country's internal social divisions. This holds as well for India and Brazil. The new multinational corporation. When viewing the globe through the lens of the region state, senior corporate managers think differently about the geographical expansion of their businesses. In the past, the primary aspiration of multinational corporations was to create, in effect, clones of the parent organization in each of the dozens of countries in which they operated. The goal of this system was to stick yet another pin in the global map to mark an increasing number of subsidiaries around the world. More recently, however, when Nestlé and Procter and Gamble wanted to expand their business in Japan from an already strong position, they did not view the effort as just another pin-sticking exercise. Nor did they treat the country as a single coherent market to be gained at once, or try as most Western companies do to establish a foothold first in the Tokyo area, Japan's most tumultuous and overcrowded market. Instead, they wisely focused on the Kansai region around Osaka and Kobe, whose 22 million residents are nearly as affluent as those in Tokyo but where competition is far less intense. Once they had on-the-ground experience on how best to reach the Japanese consumer, they branched out into other regions of the country. Much of the difficulty Western companies face in trying to enter Japan stems directly from trying to shoulder their way in through Tokyo. This instinct often proves difficult and costly. Even if it works, it may also prove a trap. It is hard to see Japan once one is bottled up in the particular dynamics of the Tokyo marketplace. Moreover, entering the country through a different regional doorway has great economic appeal. Measured by aggregate GNP, the Kansai region is the seventh largest economy in the world, just behind the United Kingdom. Given the variations among local markets and the value of learning through real-world experimentation, an incremental region-based approach to market entry makes excellent sense. And not just in Japan. Building an effective presence across a landmass the size of China is of course a daunting prospect. Serving the people in and around Nagoya City, however, is not. If one wants a presence in Thailand, why start by building a network over the entire extended landmass? Instead focus, at least initially, on the region around Bangkok, which represents the lion's share of the total potential market. The same strategy applies to the United States. To introduce a new top-of-the-line car into the US market, why replicate upfront an exhaustive coast-to-coast dealership network? Of the country's 3,000 statistical metropolitan areas, 80% of luxury car buyers can be reached by establishing a presence in only 125 of these. The challenges for government. Traditional issues of foreign policy, security and defense remain the province of nation-states. So, two, are macroeconomic and monetary policies the taxation and public investment needed to provide the necessary infrastructure and incentives for region-based activities. The government will also remain responsible for the broad requirements of educating and training citizens so that they can participate fully in the global economy. Governments are likely to resist giving up the power to intervene in the economic realm or to relinquish their impulses for protectionism. The illusion of control is soothing. Yet hard evidence proves the contrary. No manipulation of exchange rates by central bankers or political appointees has ever corrected the trade imbalances between the United States and Japan. Nor has any trade talk between the two governments. Whatever cosmetic actions these negotiations may have prompted, they rescued no industry and revived no economic sector. Textiles, semiconductors, autos, consumer electronics, the competitive situation in these industries did not develop according to the whims of policymakers but only in response to the deeper logic of the competitive marketplace. If US market share has dwindled, it is not because government policy failed but because individual consumers decided to buy elsewhere. If US capacity has migrated to Mexico or Asia, it is only because individual managers made decisions about cost and efficiency. The implications of region states are not welcome news to established seats of political power, be they politicians or lobbyists. Nation states by definition require a domestic political focus, while region states are ensconced in the global economy. Region states that sit within the frontiers of a particular nation share its political goals and aspirations. However, region states welcome foreign investment and ownership whatever allows them to employ people productively or to improve the quality of life. They want their people to have access to the best and cheapest products. And they want whatever surplus accrue from these activities to ratchet up the local quality of life still further and not to support distant regions or to prop up distressed industries elsewhere in the name of national interest or sovereignty. When a region prospers, that prosperity spills over into the adjacent regions within the same political confederation. Industry in the area immediately in and around Bangkok has prompted investors to explore options elsewhere in Thailand. Much the same is true of Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, Jakarta in Indonesia, or Singapore, which is rapidly becoming the unofficial capital of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Sao Paulo, too, could well emerge as a genuine region state, someday entering the ranks of the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. Yet if Brazil's central government does not allow the Sao Paulo region state finally to enter the global economy, the country as a whole may soon fall off the roster of the newly industrialized economies. Unlike those at the political center, the leaders of region states interested chief executive officers, heads of local unions, politicians at city and state levels often welcome and encourage foreign capital investment. They do not go abroad to attract new plants and factories only to appear back home on television vowing to protect local companies at any cost. These leaders tend to possess an international outlook that can help diffuse many of the usual kinds of social tensions arising over issues of foreign versus domestic inputs to production. In the United States, for example, the Japanese have already established about 120 transplant auto factories throughout the Mississippi Valley. More are on the way. As their share of the U.S. auto industry's production grows, people in that region who look to these plants for their livelihoods and for the tax revenues needed to support local communities will stop caring whether the plants belong to U.S. or Japanese-based companies. All they will care about are the regional economic benefits of having them there. In effect, as members of the Mississippi Valley region staten, they will have leveraged the contribution of these plans to help their region become an active participant in the global economy. Region states need not be the enemies of central governments. Handled gently, region states can provide the opportunity for eventual prosperity for all areas within a nation's traditional political control. When political and industrial leaders accept and act on these realities, they help build prosperity. When they do not falling back under the spell of the nationalist economic illusion, they may actually destroy it. Consider the fate of Silicon Valley, that great early engine of much of America's microelectronics industry. In the beginning it was an extremely open and entrepreneurial environment. Of late, however, it has become notably protectionist, creating industry associations, establishing a polished lobbying presence in Washington and turning to competitiveness studies as a way to get more federal funding for research and development. It has also begun to discourage, and even to bar, foreign investment, let alone foreign takeovers. The result is that Boise and Denver now prosper in electronics, Japan is developing a Silicon Island on Kyushu, Taiwan is trying to create a Silicon Island of its own, and Korea is nurturing a Silicon Peninsula. This is the worst of all possible worlds, no new money in California and a host of newly energized and well-funded competitors. Elsewhere in California, not far from Silicon Valley, the story is quite different. When Hollywood recognized that it faced a severe capital shortage, it did not throw up protectionist barriers against foreign money. Instead, it invited Rupert Murdoch into 20th Century Fox, Sei Ito and Toshiba into Time Warner, Sony into Columbia, and Matsuda into MCA. The result, a $10 billion infusion of new capital and, equally important, $10 billion less for Japan or anyone else to set up a new Hollywood of their own. Political leaders, however reluctantly, must adjust to the reality of economic regional entities if they are to nurture real economic flows. Resistant governments will be left to reign over traditional political territories as all meaningful participation in the global economy migrates beyond their well-preserved frontiers. Canada, as an example, is wrongly focusing on Quebec and national language tensions as its core economic and even political issue. It does so to the point of still wrestling with the teaching of French and English in British Columbia, when that province's economic future is tied to Asia. Furthermore, as NAFTA takes shape, the vertical relationships between Canadian and U.S. regions Vancouver and Seattle, the Pacific Northwest region staten, Toronto, Detroit and Cleveland, the Great Lakes region staten, will become increasingly important. How Canadian leaders deal with these new entities will be critical to the continuance of Canada as a political nation. In developing economies, history suggests that when GNP per capita reaches about $5,000, discretionary income crosses an invisible threshold. Above that level, people begin wondering whether they have reasonable access to the best and cheapest available products and whether they have an adequate quality of life. More troubling for those in political control, citizens also begin to consider whether their government is doing as well by them as it might. Such a performance review is likely to be unpleasant. When governments control information and in large measure because they do, it is all too easy for them to believe that they own their people. Governments begin restricting access to certain kinds of goods or services or pricing them far higher than pure economic logic would dictate. If market-driven levels of consumption conflict with a government's pet policy or general desire for control, the obvious response is to restrict consumption. So what if the people would choose otherwise if given the opportunity? Not only does the government withhold that opportunity, but it also does not even let the people know that it is being withheld. Regimes that exercise strong central control either fall on hard times or begin to decompose. In a borderless world, the deck is stacked against them. The irony, of course, is that in the name of safeguarding the integrity and identity of the center, they often prove unwilling or unable to give up the illusion of power in order to seek a better quality of life for their people. There is at the center an understandable fear of letting go and losing control. As a result, the center often ends up protecting weak and unproductive industries and then passing along the high cost to its people, precisely the opposite of what a government should do. The goal is to raise living standards. The Clinton administration faces a stark choice as it organizes itself to address the country's economic issues. It can develop policy within the framework of the badly dated assumption that success in the global economy means pitting one nation's industries against another's. Or it can define policy with the awareness that the economic dynamics of a borderless world do not flow from such contrived head-to-head confrontations, but rather from the participation of specific regions in a global nexus of information, skill, trade and investment. If the goal is to raise living standards by promoting regional participation in the borderless economy, then the less Washington constrains these regions, the better off they will be. By contrast, the more Washington intervenes, the more citizens will pay for automobiles, steel, semiconductors, white wine, textiles or consumer electronics, all in the name of protecting America. Aggregating economic policy at the national level, or worse, at the continent-wide level as in Europe, inevitably results in special interest groups and vote-conscious governments putting their own interests first. The less Washington interacts with specific regions, however, the less it perceives itself as representing them. It does not feel right. When learning to ski, one of the toughest and most counterintuitive principles to accept is that one gains better control by leaning down toward the valley, not back against the hill. Letting go is difficult. For governments, region-based participation in the borderless economy is fine, except where it threatens current jobs, industries or interests. In Japan, a nation with plenty of farmers, food is far more expensive than in Hong Kong or Singapore, where there are no farmers. That is because Hong Kong and Singapore are open to what Australia and China can produce far more cheaply than they could themselves. They have opened themselves to the global economy, thrown their weight forward, as it were, and their people have reaped the benefits. For the Clinton administration, the irony is that Washington today finds itself in the same relation to those region states that lie entirely or partially within its borders as was London with its North American colonies centuries ago. Neither central power could genuinely understand the shape or magnitude of the new flows of information, people and economic activity in the regions nominally under its control. Nor could it understand how counterproductive it would be to try to arrest or distort these flows in the service of nation-deafened interests. Now as then, only relaxed central control can allow the flexibility needed to maintain the links to regions gripped by an inexorable drive for prosperity.